Hello, this is the first of a series of podcasts working through electric fields, magnetic fields, and eventually up to comets. I've had a recent interest in comets and I've realised that there's a lot to understand about comets, but the actual basic scientific understanding with which I can explain things are just not there. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I explain things scientific. And I've tried to go in a bit of greater depth, perhaps if you're homeschooling or perhaps if you're a scientist and have children at school and the teachers say, what's the explanation? Well, it's the explanations in the textbook. That's what I've taught, and there's no deeper understanding, except there's a sort of slightly chilling, threatening feeling when they really don't understand something and they actually try and just push it forward. So I'm going to be less threatening, but you're going to have to bear with me as I explain things in more depth. So electric fields. The major thing I want to get into in this talk is electric fields. This is the idea of forces at a distance. So electricity comes from the Greek electra, which is their word for amber. And amber is a natural plastic, which is epoxy, basically a resin. It's a resin which comes out of trees to heal wounds. It's sort of like this plastic wound healing stuff called amber or sap. This comes out, it cross links and forms a clear plastic. So if you know Jurassic Park, there's insects which get caught in this. So it's a juice which comes out of trees, and when it goes in a wound, it actually seals it off as a piece of plastic. So the Greeks used to get this and polish it up, and if you rub it very hard, it will pick up bits of dust. Now for you at home, they're probably best to get a chopstick, but a plastic ruler, and to get some paper towel and rub the plastic with some paper towel. And the important thing is the paper towel is a dry and clean surface, and it will heat up, remove the moisture. So removing the moisture is a critical point for getting a good charge. So you can have some comb if you're combing your hair, rubbing a balloon, but also plastic. If you rub a piece of plastic, you can actually pick up little bits of paper. Now, what's very evident here is that this electricity has a force over space, because you hold it above the table, a few centimetres above the table, and the little bits of lint will become polarised. Well, let's discuss how this happens. You've got a neutral piece of paper. The electric field will such that the your plastic will generally be positive. The negative charges in your piece of paper, which is a bit moist. It's got some electricity flowing in. The electrons will flow to the positive charge of your piece of plastic, and this means that you will have a piece of paper, one side's negatively charged, one side's positively charged, and that negative charge will be enough to get it first to rotate, set up, and eventually leave, travelling down the field gradient of your electric charge. And we're going to discuss what's happening in there. We're going to skip over a few things. So I think it was Gilbert who first worked out that there was a gas or some substance behind electric charge. So he worked out that it was some sort of theory. Dr. Gilbert is Queen Elizabeth's the first, so this is back in Renaissance after Henry VIII, way back then, around the time of Francis Bacon, really back in the early Renaissance. He worked out that charge, there was some sort of thing with electricity. You didn't have positive or negative, and so he did basic demonstrations with electricity. So he's really the first person which took it from observation into a half scientific theory. After that, Benjamin Franklin came up with the idea of electricity being more fluid, that it could flow into charged things. This famous kite and key experiment, and there was negative and positive charges. Now, I suppose what we're going to try and do is actually skip through that. You can read it in books and do basic experiments at home. We're going to try and get towards the idea of fields, and that is that a charge, an electron, which has got a negative charge, will exert a field throughout, in fact, throughout the universe. It will actually, talking more in terms of advanced physics, it will actually distort the its bane, its electric space, and cause other electrons to accelerate away from it, or positive charges to accelerate towards it. There will be a force at a distance. It will be a bit equivalent to gravity. And so we've got these field forces which act over a distance in, in different ways. In fact, all forces act over distances. Some act over large distances. The ones that act over large-ish distances are electric fields, magnetic fields, which we'll discuss much further on, and gravitational fields. And these are the things which are not forces at a distance, and you require the concept of fields to describe it. So I have a spot. I'm not going to talk for the moment. I'm going to talk about a positive charge, which is a positive electron, positron, or an antimatter electron, or a positive charge. Could be just a, say, a hydrogen ion or a proton just sitting there. That will be a positive charge. And we will describe the forces at distance with the concept of fields. Now, the word field is an interesting word. I'm going to stop there so we can actually get an idea of what that means. So in advanced science, we talk about a bane and a tension in that bane and stretching in the bane and things inside that bane experiencing a acceleration. But we're going to talk about the overarching idea of fields. Now, I'm going to take... I've sort of read the various scientists and the histories of this, and the word field itself refers to, in English, an open expanse of ground which you can navigate, and you plant a crop in it. In general, you work in a field, there's a grassy meadow, a field, and in that field there is a crop. And in general, it means that I have a region of space in which I know that in every square meter there's going to be a few hundred grams of seeds. And so it's something in English, it's got the idea of a space, and inside it, in that space, at a lone location, is a certain amount of something. And you can see where I'm going here. But the actual other definition of field is a field of influence. So a personality, someone who is speaking, they're in a room and they have an influence over the people around them, but less influence at a greater distance. So that was the more conceptual idea of field. So you've got a field, a mathematical view as a space with a value in it, a field as force over a distance to do with people and personality. And when you actually look at the way fields are drawn, they have originally a religious background, because the person who really developed the idea of field lines, which is Faraday, was a religious person and used to make copper etchings of God and good rays coming out of God's hands or out of his head or various things going down and influencing things. These lines, which would be these copper etching lines, would be these lines of field force to represent the picture of the field. So the field, as a drawn, had a picture in art first, the idea that light would come into an area and illuminate and create a warmth in the area, a field of light. It's a very ancient idea. William Thomas, or Lord Kelvin, is the first person which tried to actually come up with the term field. So William Thomas was an engineer in Belfast, and he was a darling of the British government because he fought against Irish Home Rule, which you can sort of imagine, and he became went over to Glasgow, and Glasgow has the River Kelvin in it. And he promoted British industry, was influenced in British industry and the steam and the scientific development of the Victorian world. And so they made him a Member of Parliament. And so myself, of Irish background, I've always a bit dubious about this Lord Kelvin person. And this Lord Kelvin person is a really... a person of his time. He got involved in politics. He got involved in banking, air travel, telegraph. He is more remembered for what he said, for the things that he said could never be done, which have been done, than anything else. But he is the person who's given us the laws of thermodynamics and entropy. And Lord Kelvin, named Lord of Glasgow, Lord of the River Kelvin, so that's why he's called Kelvin, and our units of temperature are in Kelvin. And he's very interesting because if you read into it, he sort of bypassed, well, let's say, Newton said the moon is attracted by the Earth by this formula, which is the gravity formula, and creates the force. And the actual mechanism of the force, if you really read into Newton, is God. So God explains everything. Descartes had a different mechanism, saying that there can be no such thing as a force at a distance. You've got to have a distortion of space, and he began to talk about these things called vortexes. So if you actually read into the Latin of Newton, I must admit, I have a bit of Latin. I have read Newton, Principalia, and it's worthwhile just going through it, and of course now Google Translate is a great thing to help you through it. So a lot of pages and pages of Newton's Principalia is Newton bagging Descartes, and obviously people ignore this, and they tend to ignore some of Newton's more dubious experiments, but he does explain them, and they are designed to poo-poo Descartes. Descartes actually didn't have... Descartes had an idea. So it's René Descartes. So he's from, I suppose, the Renaissance area, the 1500s. If you can imagine the Three Musketeers, he was one of those... He was a musketeer. He was a soldier. He was... a very subtle person. He saw the treatment that philosophers had when they actually challenged the church, so he actually avoided doing that type of stuff. But he had this theory of vortexes to explain action at a distance, that is, and it was actually rather close to our most advanced theory of space-time being bent. He would very much recognise Einstein's stuff, I would believe. So this is important because if you read William Thomson's work or Lord Kelvin's work, he talks exclusively about these vortices. He actually ignores, he's a bit scathing of Maxwell and the theory of light. He's saying, oh look, that's a theory of light, and there is a reason for it. Because he says, look, there's got to be vortices. We haven't quite discovered the mechanical reason of light, but we will discover a mechanical reason of light in the ether. So he's a really, really set in there, dyed in the wool person. But he came up with this idea of a field. And the first definition that we have of a field, which is very similar to the agrarian or farm definition of field, a field is a description of space, X, Y, Z of space, and at every point in space I can put a value of that there. So, he really came up with the what we call a scalar field. So, your everyday experience of a scalar field would be pressure. So every point you walk around your house or go up a ladder and take points, you've got the pressure there. You've got a reading of the pressure. And that's a scalar field. That is, a scalar is a single number. Another definition would be temperature. You've got a temperature probe, a thermometer, and you stick it at different points in the fridge, and you get the XYZ points in this fridge. You will have a body of data, like a computer body of data, an array of data, and at the XYZ coordinates of that data, you will have a number, and that's called a scalar field. There's also something called a vector field, and you will experience a vector field if you experience wind. So wind has got a force and a direction, and indeed, if you walk around a field or go up and down a ladder in a field, you'll be able to measure the wind at different points along there, and the wind will actually squall around. And there's a few things across with that. Now, again, is if you go beyond that, you can actually have fluid dynamics and vectors and fluids and stuff like that. But we're talking about a force, and so we're not talking about mass transport. We're talking about representation of space where every point in that space is got some information. And so that, just going again, you've got your scalar field. The most important scalar field, in fact, is the Higgs boson scalar field. That is, there's a certain amount of Higgs boson for every point in space. That's an interesting scalar field. A vector field that you'd experience is gravity. So at every particular point in time, you can hold a pendulum, and your pendulum, or you hold a series of scales, your scales will point... At that point, the force of gravity, force on that point in space is actually pointing downwards and a certain strength. So if you climb a mountain, the force will be a little bit less. So if you get into an aircraft, it'll be a little bit less still. So that's a vector field. Now, what's interesting is that Lord Kelvin described what a field was mathematically, and Maxwell then churns this through and created electric and magnetic field and generated light fields. A very highly abstract area of mathematics, and Lord Kelvin then reread what was done with his idea of fields and said, look, I don't recognise it. It's good, it's amazing, it can explain it, but I really can't understand it. It's quite hard to understand. And we're not going to do light, we're actually going to do a small little charge. So we're going to start off with just practicality of describing how you draw a field and stuff like that. Now, remember that field lines are not real. So field lines were an artistic imagination of someone called Michael Faraday. Michael Faraday asked the same James Clerk Maxwell, can you please give me some scientific... I've got this etching, I've got these religious drawings, I've got these lines drawing and the electric drawing. It seems to work. It seems a beautiful artistic cartoon understanding of a force, a field at a distance. Can you explain it? And James Clerk Maxwell said, look, unfortunately, my friend, they were actually good friends, they could actually speak with each other, and that he explained that, no, your field lines are an artistic imagination. They don't actually have anything. I think in Faraday's obituary, Maxwell wrote that the field lines are a genius idea, but it's of some lines of some ancient civilization which has become lost, as if we've seen it. So it's as if we've seen field lines drawn on some Egyptian tomb. It's an idea which doesn't exist in our modern world. But we're going to start off with the field lines are the mainstay of school stuff. And at school, you're taught that they are real. And if you said anything differently, you'd just lose points. You'd go to the bottom of the class. So let's talk about field lines. The field lines have the following points that they start off at a positive charge and finish at a minus charge. So you could have it that for every positive charge you have, you start drawing a field line out from that positive charge, and it will finish at a negative charge, and you will, on that field line, draw a arrow from the positive charge to the negative charge. Now, if you have a million positive charges and a million negative charges, you've rubbed a balloon in your hair and seen the static electricity. Rather than drawing a million line, you can draw one line for every million, or one line for every billion charges. And you have your rules. The first rule is that the electric field lines start at a positive charge and finish at a negative charge. They never cross, and for charges arrayed on a surface, say a metal sphere, in something metal, the charges are allowed to move around the place, and because they repel from each other, they will be equally spaced on a metal sphere. There's a bit more to understanding it. They'll be equally spaced, but they'll be repelled from each other, but they will tend to gather at points and at small radius of curvature. So there's a lot of science to go across that, and of course, obviously, when you're teaching kids that, you sort of avoid that. So the charges will appear on the surface of metal. So if they're inside a metal, they will be repelled from each other, and they will be repelled to the surface of things. I'm just trying to think of something. Say if you're in a party room and someone serves some really yucky dip, and you want to be away from the dip, and someone really smells. You know, everyone thinks someone really smells, and you, a party room, everyone will go to the walls that attempt to get away from each other. So charges will be at the walls. So your first rule is that field lines start as a line drawn from a positive charge to a negative charge. Second rule is that the charges, if they're on a metal sphere, in something metal, will go to the very surface of the metal. The third rule after that is that the field lines will emerge at perpendicular from the surface of the metal. And there's a piece of maths to explain why that is. And the fourth rule is that the field lines will not cross. Now, the next thing is that in real life, field lines are in three dimensions. So if you, in your hand, you have an apple, in your left hand, an orange. The apple's positively charged, the orange is negatively charged. Your field lines will, if you were able to put pins equidistant in your orange and in your apple, the positive charges will be positive in your apple. Each of those field lines will go in three-dimensional space. There'll be one, if you hold it, which hoops upwards towards your nose. There'll be one which hoops downwards towards your lap and goes up. There'll be another one which goes at the leftmost point out into space and eventually hoops around through the room and comes in at the rear. There'll be another line going direct, it's a string between your apple and orange, and you connect all of these up. And one of the things is that this is a three-dimensional space thing. And one of the fictions that we do is that we draw field lines in two dimensions on a piece of paper. And we draw them with the field lines all being squished down to two dimensions. And so the field lines count and move across. So we get the people, the kids, to actually draw field lines such that we can correct them, make them correct. But they're nothing to do with anything, any physical reality. Field lines themselves are not confined to two dimensions. So typically you will ask a student to draw the field lines between a positive and a negative charge, and they're on a piece of paper, and they will draw one direct, one from the top of the sphere, the circle, hooping up and going up to the other top, symmetrical, and the other one across, and another one going off the page and back into the page on the other side. And really, that's a fiction. And one of the things is that you would say, well, double the number of charges. You have to double the number of field lines if that's a convection there. And those field lines tell you the amount of force. So you've got those four rules for drawing field lines. That is, they start at positive and end at negative. The charges distribute them on the surface of a metal object, on the surface of metal objects. The field lines emerge at 90 degrees perpendicular to the surface, and they never cross. Now, what happens is that the actual density of field lines give you the actual intensity of the field lines. So what was a thing that you required a computer array of XYZ and two numbers in each of those XYZ coordinates with the strength, and I suppose three numbers, the strength and the two angle numbers to say which it's pointing. You need three numbers. Describe it as a field. I have a very simple shorthand which describes the direction of force, because I can see the direction from the field line, and from the actual density, I can see the amount. So if the field lines are close together, I can say that's a large value. So it's a convenient shorthand. Unfortunately, it's something developed by Michael Faraday, and it's actually got no mathematical or physics basis beyond the field lines. However, we can actually get nature to visualize it. So going back to your pieces of paper, which we picked up with a piece of amber or a piece of plastic. Those pieces of paper that we had on the table began to lift up. They became polarized. That is, your charge ruler, it's got a positive charge, and that tended to draw electrons in your piece of paper up to one end. And so your piece of paper became charged at the top, at one end, towards the ruler, and positively charged, and that would tend to make the piece of paper turn a slight bit. And if the charge was sufficiently strong, it would actually mean the piece of paper would actually be lifted up and moved across into your ruler. And the important thing here is that you need your piece of paper being sufficiently big, such the electric field will be different between the top, the leading edge, and the back end edge of your little scrap of paper. And only then, when it's sufficiently big, will it actually jump across to your ruler. Now, this is important in terms of demonstrating electric fields. And I'm going to have to go back and just give you a little brief on my preferred electric field generator, high value electric field generator. And this is not a Van de Graaff generator, which we'll describe possibly a bit later. This is called a Wimhurst machine. So this is from Victoria in England. These two rotating plastic discs, counter-rotating plastic discs, with little petals of steel on it, and a series of beautiful pickups and capacitors on it. You spin it around with the little crank, and it provides very high voltage. As you turn the handle, it will counter-rotate these things, and the charge will build up, and the charge will actually juggle the charge and produce beautiful high voltages and capacitors. And sort of this has got a beautiful advantage that just tends to work in all types of weather, as opposed to your Van de Graaff. It quickly dissipates the charge. It doesn't require plugging into electricity. It's fun. It produces a spark. The great thing is that you can take the high and low voltage off in this and put this into a petri dish of oil. And there's lots of fantastic experiments you can do with this. So I've got a petri dish of oil, and I have the positive and the negative charge. You just have your alligator chip sitting into it. And when you see it, you can actually when you wind it up, the oil becomes polarized and begins to wave and ripple between. You can actually see the oil move between the two points. But what you put into that is something called dried grass seed. Not wet grass seed. So the grass seed has the advantage is that it's dry on the outside, but it's got a little bit of grass seed on the inside, and that becomes easily polarized. And what this happens is that the little grass seed will rotate and form a rotate in the field, and it floats in the oil, so that's great. What happens is that if it's positively charged, the negative charge of that grass seed end will point to that positive charge. It'll become polarized. The electric field will move the charges within it. And what will happen is that that will, in effect, concentrate the field through the grass seed. And if you draw it, because it's an opposing dipole, it will reduce the field on the outside. So what it will mean is that if you do this correctly and sprinkle your grass seeds in properly, you will get a physical manifestation of what people draw as electric field lines. These grass seeds will head tail, and connect from your positive to your negative electrode in a beautiful line, mathematically forming in two dimensions, because it's floating, a two-dimensional surface there. And this will be a physical demonstration of field lines. Now, this is pretty much all I have to say about field lines at the moment. I suppose what I have covered is the origin of field lines, some of the history, the Lord Kelvin, who's came up with the idea of fields and was surprised by Maxwell, who used it as in a mathematical sense, and Michael Faraday, who had an artistic view of field lines, a religious view of field lines, and the way that's a religious representation of something which is really not a physics concept. However, in almost religious observance, we have a way of teaching or drilling our students to produce it, and the field lines actually have a way of telling us the direction and intensity. So if the field lines come together, if they have a high density, they have a high strength. And so they describe, field lines are a beautiful artistic way of sketching the intensity of a field or force at a distance. It doesn't really explain what's going on. And finally, I've explained a way with a Wimhurst generator, oil and grass seeds, of actually getting this to formulate, to show it. And I suppose the important thing is that by drilling students in two dimensions and saying, look, my way of getting you to produce something which you can produce by a test means that, unfortunately, that when you start to talk to students about field lines in three dimensions, and the fact that the picture that you show on the board of two charges and the field lines going through it is a squashed two-dimensional view, they become very confused. Now, it's not bad teaching, it's just the fact that we are teaching in a particular direction to get a particular result, a particular time, and it's sort of like a bus journey which takes you rather than to the old city, the interesting historical city, it takes you to an industrial estate, and you just get out there and people are none the wiser. So that's probably not a good way of explaining. Now, the idea that I want to talk about field lines is that there's a discussion later on about drawing magnetic field lines and magnetism, and eventually a discussion on comets, which I want to get to, and how you do that sort of things. So this is Peter Hill Explains, and I hope this is of some value to you, particularly if you are homeschooling or a scientist who is trying to make sense of the school textbooks, and to know that there's a bit more to it there, where there's a tendency to quote famous people like Lord Kelvin up to the point that it supports what's taught at school, but obviously there's a lot more interesting aspects to it. There's a tendency to support Newton, but and to give reverence of Newton, but ultimately he does not actually provide a mechanical mechanism for gravity, nor does Maxwell provide, or anyone provide, a mechanical mechanism for why charge will operate at a distance. So this is Peter Hill Explains, and I hope this has been useful. Thanks for listening, and in the meantime, keep on doing science.